The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is writer Anita Diamant, author of the new book Day After Night, and the international bestseller The Red Tent. We'll also have a visit from our Mavina on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. February is a quiet month in many ways. For one thing, it's short. For another, after the Super Bowl today, there is no football to worry about. And since there are actually no Jewish players or owners or coaches in this Super Bowl, although it is being played in Miami, possibly the second most Jewish-feeling American city after New York, we might as well begin to focus on the coming holiday of Purim at the end of February. It's still 3 weeks away, but well worth starting to enjoy. Purim celebrates the events of the Book of Esther in the Bible, and it is quite likely the most purely fun Jewish festival of all. To start a pre-Purim preview of tunes for the holiday of Hamantaschen, here's Michael Isaacson's Esther the Queen.
Let us remember with true emotion, let us pay homage to Esther the Queen, and rekindle the ember of true devotion. Esther, we give you our blessed esteem. Let us honor the day that we set for Purim, honor the story and all it can mean, for the valorous way that she saved our people, honor the glory of Esther the Queen. We know Haman, foe of Israel, plotted a slaughter. Each son and daughter soon would fall. But Esther sought the king, Ahasuerus. She stood before him, proud and tall. Saved us all. Nations may flourish on high ambition, only to weaken and pass from the scene. But the Hebrews will nourish their strong tradition, always protecting, always reflecting, always perfecting, lest we forget that we yet are indebted to Esther. Lest we forget that we yet are indebted to Esther. Lest we forget that we yet are indebted to Esther the Queen. Esther the Queen!
That was Esther the Queen for the coming holiday of Purim, February 27th and 28th, although some of us are having our shows and carnivals on February 21st. It's been a pretty quiet news time in Israel recently, but an issue has come to the forefront this week that's worth talking about. First, after a careful process of reading and analysis, Israel has responded to the infamous Goldstone report published by the United Nations. That report came out in September and harshly criticized Israel's conduct during the Gaza War last year, while mostly absolving Hamas of any misconduct. Israel's published response to the Goldstone report, delivered the day of the three-month deadline from the UN, comprehensively demolishes the many unfounded allegations that the UN Commission made. The long and short of it, and the original Goldstone report was some 547 pages long, while the Israeli response is considerably shorter. The long and the short of it is that Israel states categorically that under extreme conditions, its soldiers observed very careful rules for engagement, that it followed policies designed to limit civilian casualties, while its own army sought to stop the rain of missiles and rockets that Hamas terrorists were showering down on Israeli civilians. Unfortunately, Hamas Palestinians dressed as civilians and hid in heavily populated civilian areas from which they fired on Israeli soldiers. Under these conditions, Israel showed great restraint, but inevitably some civilians were killed and wounded tragically. As Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister and a former guest of Two Jewish and a former prime minister, by the way, said, there was no army as responsible, moral, and accurate, even under impossible conditions, as Israel's. Barak also added that the Goldstone report is distorted, falsified, and not balanced. Well, all of that is true. Israeli officials say the submission to the UN was not intended to respond in detail to the many allegations and incidents outlined in the report, but to explain why the Israeli justice system was reliable and independent, which it is. When UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon makes his own recommendations for further actions this month, he is not expected to advocate a process leading to international criminal trials, as proposed by South African Judge Richard Goldstone, who headed the commission. We'll see how Israel's response is perceived internationally. My own sense is that it won't have much impact on the UN itself, but it may have some effect on public perception around the world. The main objective Israel had was to avoid some sort of trumped-up war crimes trial. It is astonishing to me that terrorists can fire thousands of explosives into civilian towns and cities. And that's not a war crime, but sending in troops to stop them from doing this somehow might be. On a happier note, when we come back in a few moments, we'll meet our guest, best-selling author Anita Diamant, who wrote The Red Tent and many other books, right here in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I'm Edmund Marquez with the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency. Are you looking for a full-service insurance agent who understands your own unique insurance needs? As a founding member of the Jewish Latino Coalition, I understand the importance of making connections in both the local and cultural communities. My family's agency has been protecting people in Tucson for 40 years with auto, home, and life insurance. I encourage you to support a local business while at the same time, take care of those who are most important to you by protecting their futures. Stop by the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency, located at Speedway just west of Swan, or call us at 323-9333 for a friendly look at your insurance needs.
The world's favorite family musical. A tradition for young and old. Fiddler on the Roof, starring Broadway's Theodore Bickel as Tevye. One of the most glowing creations in the history of musical theater, Fiddler on the Roof, starring the legendary Theodore Bickel as Tevye.
At the Tucson Music Hall, February 23rd to the 28th. Buy tickets at BroadwayandTucson.com.
We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish, Anita Diamant. She was first on the show, I would say, 4 years ago, talking about the Mikvah Project, maybe longer. She is one of the most prominent authors on the American Jewish scene, has written extensively, both in nonfiction and in fiction, and has worked and become, I would say, a leading voice within the Jewish world. Had the privilege of hearing her recently at the Union for Reform Judaism Biennial, speaking about the concept of Minhag America, what it means to be an American Jew today. Her new book is just out, called Day After Night, and she's best known, I would expect, as the author of The Red Tent. Welcome, Anita. Pleasure to have you back.
It's great to be here again. Thank you.
So, in brief, tell me about writing Day After Night.
Day After Night came about because I visited my daughter when she was in Israel on EIE, which is a semester program run by the Reform Movement, and my husband and I went for our first trip to Israel. We went on their field trips with them.
That was your first trip to Israel?
That was my first trip to Israel.
My goodness.
In 2001.
Okay.
So one of the stops on our field trips in their study of contemporary or modern Jewish history in the state of Israel was a place called Atlit, which was a detention camp where the British, when they were in control of Palestine, would intern, imprison really, what were called illegal immigrants to Palestine, Jewish immigrants who had escaped from Europe. This was in 1945, the story we were told, right after the war. And they were put behind barbed wire fences again, re-traumatizing a lot of people, and learned this amazing story about a daring escape, breaking out all of the prisoners from the camp in October of 1945. It was a great story, and I thought, wow, what a great novel that would make. So that's where the idea came from.
Now, a lot of your protagonists are Holocaust survivors.
Yes, they are.
Who get involved in helping to found the State of Israel. It's a great story. It's not a very widely told story.
No, and the story of the escape is not well known, certainly in the United States or outside of the State of Israel. But the story really focuses on these four young women who have four very different stories of survival in Europe during the war years, and coming to a very strange new land, new world, new language, and trying to make sense both of the loss of their past and building a new future, a new identity in this new land. So that's kind of it's a book about resilience in a way, about human resilience, in particular Jewish resilience.
And maybe in particular Jewish women's resilience.
Yes, I tend to focus on that.
Might be connecting to some themes that we will talk about a little later on to Jewish when we return with author Anita Diamant.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times, from their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce. You are sure to find something perfect for your taste. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences.
All day long I bitty bitty bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to wear a...
The most thoroughly fun Jewish holiday of all is coming to Temple Emmanuel in the greatest show yet. Sunday, February 21st at 10 a.m., the Purim Extravaganza Show and Spectacular Carnival will make this fabulously fun festival into a wonderful celebration for all ages. It's Purim on the Roof, a wonderful parody of Fiddler on the Roof, exploring the story of the Book of Esther in full musical theater style, including takeoffs on all the classic songs of Fiddler, and featuring a Tevye like you've never seen before. It's a Purim day filled with comedy, clowning, magic, games, and fabulous food. Plus, don't miss the finest hamantaschen in all of Arizona. Everyone's invited, and the Purim show and carnival are absolutely free. Call 327-4501 for information. Come one, come all, to the biggest and best Purim celebration in Arizona. All at Temple Emmanuel, Sunday, February 21st at 10 a.m. Call 327-4501 for Purim Extravaganza Fun for adults and children.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. You don't call, you don't write. Well, you could call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O Jewish. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcast to which you can subscribe. The Oscar nominations are in for films that debuted in 2009, and there are some interesting Jewish stories among them. This year, they've decided to double the number of Best Picture nominees. Not sure why. Some years doesn't seem like there are five good movies in there. But in any case, among the films up for Best Picture this year are the Coen brothers' A Serious Man, a very Jewish film, the gory Quentin Tarantino film Inglourious Basterds, a reimagining of World War II with Jews gaining revenge on Hitler and the Nazis, and the British film An Education, which also has a Jewish element. It is perhaps notable that all of these films have troubling aspects to them for Jews, even though they're kind of Jewish. Both A Serious Man and An Education have been called slightly anti-Semitic, though I'm not sure either one really is, while Inglourious Basterds relishes its Jews doing great violence. Not exactly Jewish values lived up there on the big screen. Still, it's a little startling to think that so many Jewish-themed films are up for Best Picture, three. Of course, since there are 10 films nominated, it might be nice if they gave an award to the best picture not named Avatar, in which case one of these movies might actually win. It's notable that three Jewish-themed movies have won Best Picture before from the Oscars: Gentleman's Agreement in 1947, Chariots of Fire in 1981, and Schindler's List in 1993. Yes, it's 17 years since Schindler's List. The Pianist, which I thought won for Best Picture, didn't, although Adrian Brody won for Best Actor in that Holocaust film. In addition, an Israeli film was nominated for the Best Foreign Language Film for the third year in a row, a movie called Ajami. Of course, there are many Jewish directors and actors nominated for Oscars, but it's nice to see Jewish-themed films coming to the fore in this way. Let's see. Three out of the 10 Best Picture nominations, that's 30%. And we represent less than 2% of the population of America, although a higher percentage of Hollywood's population. Still, not bad. We welcome our Mavinar expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, we are not a shy people, we Jews, most of us. There's a Yiddish phrase, shemzachnish, which means don't be shy, but really that's redundant with most Jews. Lots of two Jews, three opinions, lots of ability to go out and speak forthrightly, but that's not always a good idea, is it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question that you raise. Shy, I think, refers to a personal sense of or lack of comfort in communicating ideas and expressing ideas. And as you've so aptly stated, we are rarely on the shy side. Jews tend to be very comfortable in expressing ideas, literary as well as verbal. When I was growing up, I grew up in a home where I could pretty easily say words went from the lung to the tongue. There was very little censorship in our home, which caused problems sometimes, because when you don't censor your words, when you don't choose your words carefully, you can really injure feelings and damage relationships. So I think we have to make a distinction between not expressing honestly what's on our mind and choosing the words that we use to express what's on our mind carefully so that we don't damage relationships or feelings. I do think there's a distinction. And, you know, a lot of it is Jewish speak is a huge topic, especially, I mean, the Chofetz Chaim, has written a lot about
The ethics of speech.
The ethics of speech. And, right. We always think of gossip, and that is a huge one. Choosing not to speak negatively or overly positively about someone that could cause that person's image to be diminished in the eyes of a third person is a very big and important concept in Judaism. You know, Lashon Hara, not speaking poorly or with evil tongue, the actual translation. But I think that there's also not speaking without thinking about how our words will affect other people is very important. I mean, when you think about how many hours people spend on choosing their clothes or the movies they go to or the books they're going to read, it's amazing. And when you think of it, generally how little time people spend in actually cultivating the words they're going to use. And I think that one thing that Judaism teaches us about expressing our ideas is if there's an idea, there's always many ways to express it. And it's not just possible, it's very probable that there's a positive way to express even a negative idea. I mean, one such way would be if we're very unhappy with someone, not to indict them or their character, but to perhaps comment on their behavior. So rather than say, "Rabbi, I don't like you, I don't like what you're doing," it would be just as easy to say, and perhaps much more Jewish to say, "I don't like this behavior when you do it," or "I find it really difficult to relate to you the way I'd like to when you speak to me like that."
I like it better when people say, "Rabbi, I don't like you and your mother dresses you funny."
You know, you need to get over that,
Rabbi.
Yeah,
I get that a lot.
Really, you need to get over that. So I think that it's not about not speaking or being shy. It's about not speaking without thinking and choosing our words so that they dignify rather than diminish the party to whom we're speaking or we're speaking about.
Thanks, Amy. We will talk next week.
Great. I look forward to it.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant on the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
I think the most special meal in all of Arizona is a dinner at Janos.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. I tell you, I'm really proud of it. We have so much fun. That's what Janos is all about. Special foods, special people, special occasions, but really using the best products available to us and really taking the time and crafting wonderful, wonderful, beautiful, and perfectly executed food.
My wife calls it, I think I've told you this before, magic food. It's just, you can't believe that it can taste quite the way it does.
No, that's nice of you to say. Well, I'll tell you, we really have a lot of fun doing it, and the flavors we use are really, really terrific. The service is great, and so we're just proud of what we do and love having people come in for dinner.
For an outstanding restaurant experience, the phone number for Janos.
615-6100. You can go online, www.janos.com.
For the best meal in all of Southern Arizona.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week we began speaking about the Greek Jewish community, been some anti-Semitic activity recently, and identified the challenge of being Jewish in a country in which being Greek also means being Greek Orthodox. That's not really the same in some of the other Mediterranean countries, including Italy, where, after all, the Roman Catholic Church is headquartered in Rome. Or Spain. Maybe we could do a little compare and contrast here.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, of course, at one time, all the countries to which you refer were part of the Roman Empire. They weren't all Latin-speaking, but they were part of the same imperium and the same system of intellectual, cultural values. And, you know, at one time, Jews were a pretty significant percentage of the population in all of those countries. Over the intervening centuries between, you know, the decline and fall of Rome and the 21st century, Arguably, in the long term, Jews did better in the countries on the southern shores of the Mediterranean, which were ruled by Muslims, places like Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, than they did in countries on the northern shores, which were ruled by, in most cases, Catholics. In the case of Greece, the Greek Orthodox, except that Greece, for many of those centuries, was under the rule of Ottoman Turks, and Jews did very well in Greece under Ottoman rule. The source of anti-Semitism in Greece, it's hard to put your finger on. First of all, there are very few Greek Jews. Second of all, it's not the traditional Roman Catholic anti-Semitism, and in fact, one generally associates anti-Semitism less with the Orthodox Church than with the Catholic Church. But these are tough economic times, and in tough economic times, people always look for scapegoats. And I think we've talked about this before, but historically, throughout Europe, Jews have played the role of sort of canary in the coal mine, warning when there's social strain and when societies were under stress, Jews were attacked. And the degree, ferocity, frequency of attacks on Jews was kind of a barometer of how healthy or unhealthy a society was. So what we may be seeing in Greece is a reflection that the economic crisis is hitting that country harder, perhaps, than certain other countries, or that the country feels more threatened, less coherent, more ambivalent about being part of the European Union. It can be lots of things that cause people to lash out at Jews. But if we take Italy by contrast, Jews also have a long history in Italy. Most of Italy was never ruled by the Turks or by any other Muslim empire. Italians are also kind of a mono-ethnic nation in the sense that to be an Italian really is to be Roman Catholic. There are very few Protestants, very few Jews, very few anything other than Roman Catholics. But the incidents of anti-Semitism that we hear about in Italy were mostly 19th century, not so much 20th century, and certainly not 21st century. So suggests that perhaps Italy is a more stable or more prosperous society than Greece, and perhaps less shaken by current economic and political events, less traumatized by the process of entering the European Union, the European monetary system, losing its national currency, et cetera, et cetera. I think all these things shook up the Greeks a lot more than they shook up the Italians. And so, you know, we as Jews often tend to see things as being about us, but it's not always about us. It's much more often about the societies in which we live, where how we are treated, how people look at us, is much more a reflection of things, of factors that are exogenous to the Jewish community and have nothing to do with Jews.
Yeah, I think that's right. I might also add, Greece has been one of the poorest of the European Union countries. Their economy has struggled. But it's also true that some of the earliest and most vicious anti-Semitic codes were Byzantine. They came from what was essentially a Greek empire long, long ago. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Jaime loves his dog very much, but one night his wife says, "Jaime, I've been meaning to tell you something for some time." "So tell me already," says Jaime. "I think you spent too much time talking to your dog," his wife says. "She can't possibly understand you. She certainly can't understand the Yiddish you use." "But she can," says Jaime. "She's a Jewish dog." His wife laughs out loud. "Don't be silly," she says. "Of course you're not Jewish. Dogs can't be Jewish." Well, Jaime is troubled, so the next day, Jaime takes his dog with him to see the rabbi. "So, Jaime," says Rabbi Gold, "how are you keeping these days? How can I help you?" "I'm fine, thank you, Rabbi, but I'm a little troubled," says Jaime. "I'm here to ask you whether my dog could be a Jewish dog. After all, my wife is Jewish, my sons are Jewish, my daughter is Jewish, but how can I tell if my dog is Jewish?" "It's a good question, Jaime," replies Rabbi Gold. He picks up his phone. "I'm going to ask my assistant, Maurice Katz, to join us. Maybe he can help us." But when Maurice Katz comes into the rabbi's office, the dog goes wild and chases Maurice, barking loudly. "Well, Jaime," says Rabbi Gold, "proof enough for me. This is indeed a Jewish dog." "But how did you arrive at that conclusion?" asks Jaime. "Because she just chased cats," replies Rabbi Gold. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Okay, that was a terrible joke. But just to balance it out, I'll ask you a quick question. Why don't people make love in public in Tel Aviv? Because passersby would stop to point out what they were doing wrong. Well, to improve matters, we now welcome our two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. This story was collected by Howard Schwartz. Once upon a time, King Solomon heard rumors from heaven that within a year his daughter was destined to marry some poor man. And King Solomon was surprised at this and not particularly happy. He thought that his daughter had been raised with the finest and she should continue to have the finest in life. And he decided to try to intercede on her fate. And so he had his workmen go to an island off in the sea on the far reaches of his kingdom. And there they constructed a great tower without a single door or window, and just an entrance on top that could be reached via pulleys. And he had this tower stocked with everything his daughter could need for the year, and he had it staffed by only woman servants. And then his daughter was sent there by boat. And she lived her life there pleasantly enough, though confused why her father was asking her to do this, but willing as it was. And during this time, it happened that in another part of Israel, a very poor young scholar named Reuben was going from town to town to town looking for work. And as he was passing in the wilderness between two towns, the sun set and the temperature dropped drastically, and he started to feel tremendously cold. And as he was sitting there shivering, he could feel the temperature continue to drop, and he knew that if he didn't find some source of warmth, he might not survive the night. And so he went looking in the moonlight until he came upon the freshly killed carcass of an ox killed by a lion. And he felt it, and sure enough, it was still warm. And as unsatisfying, unpleasing as it was, he took out his knife and he sliced open the abdomen and slipped inside for the little bit of warmth that it could afford. And it was enough. In that warmth, he managed to fall asleep and into a deep sleep. And such a deep sleep that he didn't notice. In the middle of the night, when a giant eagle came flying by, saw the carcass, and thinking to carry it off to some roost where she could feed on it, picked up the carcass and carried it all the way off to an island where there was a tower, a convenient place for the eagle to rest. And there she set the carcass down. She fed a little bit, and once she had her fill, she went flying off again. And Reuben remained sleeping inside. And that morning, when Solomon's daughter stepped onto the roof to watch the sun rise over the ocean, she was horrified to find this carcass of an ox, and how much more so when it moved and out of it popped a young man. And the two of them screamed, seeing the other. And then they realized what had happened. And, well, he couldn't go anywhere. He was trapped in this tower without a door or a window on an island, and so he was compelled to remain. And, well, they got to like each other, they got to marry each other, and they got to having a baby. So that a year passed, and Solomon arrived by boat to pick up his own daughter, only to find she had married a poor man, and they had a child. And Solomon welcomed the young man into the family with a grin on his face, for now he knew you can't change destiny.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as nearly any other part of the whole Torah. To tell you the truth, after the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring some of the greatest stories in the entirety of Jewish tradition, indeed of all religious history, Mishpatim comes as a major letdown. Last week, amid the fire and smoke of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. And in the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how we interact with other human beings. You might call it civil legislation. How exciting. How we handle somebody else's property. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or who destroys somebody else's stuff. how to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you, laws of manslaughter and theft and damages. If the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not to belong in the Torah at all. So why is Mishpatim here? We human beings have no love of law or lawyers. But without laws and without enforcement, we fallible creatures wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would likely tear each other apart. And where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. That's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law and we need limits, although we might not like either one. Judaism understands that if we are truly to be good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. At the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws, these torts and talionuses, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. In this way, Mishpatim teaches us that we can only experience real holiness when we begin to respect our fellow men and women, when we come to understand that we are all in this together, that the way to God is through the ways we learn to work together and trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways, by following decent rules for human interaction. Poet Adrian Rich put it well, "These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life. Freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Now, freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds. Freedom and holiness depend on the little laws established here in Mishpatim, and we can achieve both when we learn and follow the best of these laws." When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews round the world and talk to best-selling writer Anita Diamond, author of The Red Tent. All that on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The diary of the notorious murderous doctor Joseph Mengele is set to be auctioned off in the U.S. Nazi memorabilia collectors vying for the artifact, belonging to the Nazi doctor known at Auschwitz as the Angel of Death, are expected to pay about $60,000. The owner of the diary acquired the volume in Brazil after Mengele died in 1979. The Historical Artifacts House Alexander Autographs in Connecticut is handling the sale. They say the owner is a source close to the Mengele family. The diary begins in May of 1960, when Josef Mengele was 49 years old. At Auschwitz, Mengele determined who would live and die. He conducted horrific quasi-medical experiments, including those on twins. News of the auction has prompted anger and revulsion among Holocaust survivors and their families. This is a cynical act of exploitation aimed at profiting from the writings of one of the most heinous Nazi criminals, a statement put out by the American Gathering of Holocaust Survivors and Their Descendants said. If the auction house will not halt the sale, we're calling on Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal to determine if he has the means to do so. A Polish court has issued a European-wide warrant for the arrest of a Swedish man suspected of ordering the theft of the famous Auschwitz sign. In more Auschwitz news, the warrant is for Anders Hagström, a former Swedish neo-Nazi. Hagström is suspected of ordering five Polish men, who have been arrested by local authorities, to steal the metal sign reading Arbeit macht frei from the front gate of the former concentration camp, which is now a memorial. Hagström reportedly acted as an agent for a British Nazi sympathizer who wanted the sign. Yuck. The warrant requires authorities in the 27 member states of the European Union to arrest Hagström, turn him over to the Polish authorities. The 16-foot metal sign, which means work makes you free, was stolen December 18th and recovered in another part of Poland 72 hours later. Experts are working to restore the sign, which had been cut into three pieces. It is not certain that the sign will be returned to its place. A copy was placed at the front gate immediately after the theft. Some 1.1 million people, including about a million Jews, were murdered at Auschwitz. The 65th anniversary of its liberation was commemorated last week with ceremonies, including a moving speech by Israeli President Shimon Peres. Ukraine's chief rabbi says he will give up his own state honor to protest that country's honoring of a wartime nationalist leader who ordered the slaughter of Jews and Poles. Rabbi Moshe Reuven Osman has asked attorneys to determine how he can return his Order of Merit honor in protest of President Viktor Yushchenko granting the Hero of Ukraine Award to Stepan Bandera, leader of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. The posthumous honor for Bandera was protested by the Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia, as well as other regional Jewish organizations. The Ukrainian nationalist forces led by Bandera fought against both the Nazis and the Soviet army in World War II and led an armed battle against Soviet rule in the Ukraine into the 1950s. Bandera and his nationalists were responsible, however, for killing thousands of Jews and Poles. Yushchenko is running last in the race for Ukrainian president with elections scheduled for today. His honor for Bandera was seen as a way to force the other candidates to take a stand on the nationalist leader of the Ukraine. Bandera was assassinated by a KGB agent in Munich back in 1959. And a leading Polish bishop has clarified statements published on a conservative Catholic website that suggest the Holocaust was a Jewish invention. Bishop Tadeusz Pironek called the episode, sparked by his interview with Pontifex.Roma, which was published last week, a complete misunderstanding. He wrote to both the Italian news agency ANSA and the Polish Catholic news agency KAI that he has actually said, as quoted, that the Shoah was a Jewish invention. But, he told ANSA, I was referring to the fact that the Jews have created the term Shoah to define the tragedy that didn't have a precedent in history. Maybe. Pironek, who is 75 years old, said, the journalist interpreted my words as if I had been saying the Jews had invented the Shoah. How could I have said something so absurd? How indeed. Everyone who knows me knows my position on the crimes of the Nazis and on the horror of what happened. Pironek, a former spokesman of the Polish Bishops' Conference, also apologized to Bruno Volpe, the Pontifex.Roma.it journalist who conducted the interview, for having accused him of manipulating his words. I apologize to Volpe and everyone who felt offended by my unintentionally unfortunate statement. I had no intention to falsify history or accuse anyone of ill will. Pontifex.Roma.it threatened legal action if Pironek had not issued an apology. You know, it sure would be nice if this little flurry of stupid comments about the Holocaust by bishops and cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church would just stop already. Perhaps this one really is the accidental misstatement the bishop claims it is. I certainly hope so. But coming on the heels of several other such comments we've heard in recent months, it makes it more important than ever that the Vatican seek to get a better handle on these matters. The Church has done tremendous work in recent decades, repairing its long history of anti-Semitic teaching and action. Be ashamed to see it tarnished by a reversion to thoughtless insensitivity at a very high level about the Holocaust. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest, Anita Diamant. She's one of the most prominent authors on the American Jewish scene. Her new book is called Day After Night, telling the story of women who lived through the Holocaust and were interned in a British internment camp in Israel, escaped, and sort of a story about resilience and about the founding of the state in some ways, too. Her writing career began in Boston back in 1975. She was a freelance journalist, contributing to a variety of publications, and then wrote a number of non-Jewish works, including The New Jewish Wedding, The New Jewish Baby Book, Living a Jewish Life, Choosing a Jewish Life, about what it was like to be Jewish, convert to Judaism, saying Kaddish, and How to Be a Jewish Parent. 1997, her first work of fiction, The Red Tent, which was inspired by a few lines in the book of Genesis, opened that out and became a galloping bestseller, unexpectedly so. 2001, it was honored as BookSense Best Fiction, and there are now editions in 25 countries worldwide. Is that right?
That's right.
And it's been translated into a number of languages and still sort of a book publishing phenomenon. She also has written Good Harbor, which was her second novel, Last Days of Dogtown, and then Day After Night. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you spoke recently, you know, I had a chance to hear you speak really extensively and interestingly about what it means to be an American Jew today.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about some of the themes, if you would, that you delineated in talking about Minhag America. You know, what does it mean to have an American practice?
Okay. Well, you know, I start from a place of feeling like this is the best time in Jewish history to be alive, to be a Jew, certainly to be a Jewish woman. The potential is enormous, the creativity, the vitality of the community, especially in America, and I really speak to the liberal American Jewish experience, which includes, I would say, modern Orthodoxy as well. It's a very broad swath of Jewish experience here, and that we live in a time of enormous freedom, enormous opportunity. We've always been, someone once famously called us the ever-dying people.
like Yiddish is the ever-dying language.
Right, exactly. But we, you know, we're very much here and very much strong and very much alive, even facing all of the challenges that we face in the world today. And I think Minhag America, which is my kind of umbrella term for what American Judaism looks like, is very diverse, very pluralistic, contentious, argumentative, what else is new, but also includes some both old and new elements that I think are new in Jewish history. And there are several of those. One of them is the full inclusion of women, which feels like old news after a couple of generations, but really if you look at all of Jewish history, the full participation of women, not just an extraordinary individual here and there, but women's voices being heard in every aspect of Jewish communal life, theology, the arts, everywhere, is really new, and it adds, it doubles our power in a way, and it's a challenge and it's a change, and it still scares a lot of people, but it's here to stay and it's not going anywhere. So that's kind of one of the big foundational ones, and the other one I would just mention is this notion that that learning is for everybody, that we are a learned and learning community. You know, we have this fantasy that in the past all the Jews knew more than the Jews know today. But in fact, serious Jewish study was limited to a very small number of men, certainly men of means or men whose families could support them. But today we have this goal, this expectation, this hope that Jews can keep learning about Judaism, about all the different aspects of Jewish culture, religion, text, everything that we've got throughout a lifetime. And we're working as a community to make that possible for everybody. And I think that's an extraordinary change. It's a very hopeful and inspiring change, I think, in Jewish life. And that's part of also what Minhag America is.
I would surely agree with that, being deeply dedicated to adult Jewish education. And, you know, after all, Two Jewish does great Jewish adult education all the time. Using the term Minhag America, you're borrowing from Isaac Meir Wise, who called his first prayer book Minhag America, the founder of the Reform Movement, really the founder of organized Judaism or Jewish religious life in America. And I like the idea that these are the good old days. You know, there's so much going on. To borrow from another great Jewish scholar, Carly Simon. But I also wonder about the possible critique which says, you know, just describing what is doesn't necessarily mean what is all good.
Oh, it's not all good. It's challenging. But I think we have a tendency to focus on what's bad and what's wrong, and let's fix and let's.
By being Jewish, of course. That's
yes, yes, but by examining what's right, by examining what's alive and juicy and a little bit dangerous also, I think that's a way to look ahead and see how can we harness these unleashed energies for the good of the Jewish people and for the good of the whole world as well.
You know, it seems to me that people respond well to nonfiction and they're appreciative of what they've learned and it helps them grow, especially the kind of nonfiction which really guides on living a Jewish life, connecting people to Jewish lives. But there's something about fiction that touches an emotional chord that nonfiction never quite reaches.
Absolutely, and I think that the arts are so such a core element of Minhag America, to get back to that as well, that the arts, music, theater, the plastic arts, the visual arts, dance, all of that touches you in a way that engages the intellect, but engages other parts of you as well. I mean, you resonate with your body and with your soul and with your spirit and your emotions to the arts in a way that strictly nonfiction or academic or journalistic input, as important as that can be, it doesn't hit as many notes. It doesn't strike chords in quite the same way.
Jews are obviously heavily involved in all of the arts, but, come back to the sort of the classic idea, because Irving Berlin wrote them, does that make Easter Parade and White Christmas Jewish songs? You know, Jews are involved in the arts, they support the arts, but the arts aren't necessarily inherently Jewish.
No, but what I find going on now, as we begin the 21st century, is a kind of brash, open Jewishness, and in, to use John Stewart's language, Jewiness,
yeah,
about
he,
the arts.
He does use that
culture
word a lot, doesn't he?
It does, and he's constantly throwing his Judaism, his Jewishness, not his Judaism,
not his Judaism,
Jewishness,
but his Jewishness, yeah,
around. I mean, last night I was watching one, and he had to bring out, he was talking to Dan Rather, and he said, I'm not going to Afghanistan, I'm too chicken, but I have an armored yarmulke. That was his last line.
Yeah.
And it's like he won't let the audience forget where he comes from, and that is, there's a kind of brazenness there. I think bands like the Klezmatics, who are founded, rooted in old klezmer music, but take off into the stratosphere, into world music, and far out beautiful pop sounds, are another example of that.
I want to thank Anita Diamant for a great visit here on Too Jewish. One last quick question. If you were going to suggest that people get the book Day After Night, what would be the single reason you would suggest they get it?
Ooh, well, I always hope that my stories are a good read and that you want to find out what happens to the characters next. So, it's really that the notion of the storyteller drawing you into the story of human lives. And so it's not that you should learn about the history of the Jewish people or the Holocaust or the founding of the State of Israel, but that all of that is braided into these characters, multiple characters, who I hope you will come to care about and become part of your own imaginative history.
The tale's the thing in this case.
Yeah.
And the characters.
Always in fiction, I think so, yeah.
I want to thank Anita Diamant again for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her most recent book is Day After Night. You can find it, everywhere.
Anywhere.
Just about.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back.
It's a great pleasure. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
All day long, I bitty, bitty bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to wear a...
The most thoroughly fun Jewish holiday of all is coming to Temple Emmanuel in the greatest show yet. Sunday, February 21st at 10 a.m., the Purim Extravaganza Show and Spectacular Carnival will make this fabulously fun festival into a wonderful celebration for all ages. It's Purim on the Roof, a wonderful parody of Fiddler on the Roof, exploring the story of the Book of Esther in full musical theater style, including takeoffs on all the classic songs of Fiddler, and featuring a Tevye like you've never seen before. It's a Purim day filled with comedy, clowning, magic, games, and fabulous food. Plus, don't miss the finest hamantaschen in all of Arizona. Everyone's invited, and the Purim show and carnival are absolutely free. Call 327-4501 for information. Come one, come all, to the biggest and best Purim celebration in Arizona. All at Temple Emmanuel, Sunday, February 21st at 10 a.m. Call 327-4501 for Purim Extravaganza Fun for adults and children.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Jane Ramsey, Executive Director of the Windy City Council on Urban Affairs and an important activist in Jewish-African-American relations. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from our pre-Purim musical preview, the classic Purim tune Chag Purim in a jazzy version from Mark Bloom. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Chag Purim, Chag Supreme, where grown-ups and kids all act like Yeladim. Exciting Ad Lo Yada, reciting Al HaNissim. It's a funky, funky holiday, this Chag Purim. As long as I remember those winters of my youth, 2 months past December and those carnival booths, I'd strut around dressed up.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.